Oh. In the matter
Oh,
of.
there. I was going to say you were on mute.
Oh, I was? Oh, my goodness. Sorry. We're here in the matter of the revocable trust of Avis Cordes under agreement dated February 12th, 2015. Welcome to the attorneys. I don't know if either of you has appeared before the court on our WebEx platform. The procedure is the same. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument. Appellant's attorney will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before you begin your argument, please introduce yourself for the record. And with that, we'll hear for attorney for appellants.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Tom Atmore on behalf of the appellants, the trustee, former trustees, Cynthia Stabenow and Scott Cordes. We're seeking reversal of two decisions from the district court. The first decision was the decision to remove the trustees on the basis that they committed a serious breach of trust. We don't think the facts or the law support that decision. And in fact, if you look at the Minnesota Supreme Court case of In re Will of Gershkow, a court should be reluctant to remove a trustee appointed by a settlor. And what I think that means is the court should try to view the evidence in such a way that it favors retaining such a trustee. And Cynthia and Scott were appointed by the settlor, Avis Cordes, but the district court did not show any reluctance in removing them. The second issue that we're asking for reversal on is the decision to deny the trust interest income under the contract for deed that was signed in June of 2019. And the court did not allow interest to be charged from January 1, 2019 through June 30, 2016. And we think that was an abuse of discretion. I want to briefly touch on the standard of review, particularly for the decision to remove trustees. Usually that is a decision that's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. When, however, the decision involves an interpretation of the trust document or interpretation of the law, then those questions are reviewed de novo. And so here what we have is a district court decision that the right of first refusal in proposed by the trustees under the contract for deed was contrary to the terms of the trust. And so that part of the decision would be—
Mr. Atmore, this is Judge Riley. I have a question for you. Do you think that the trust is ambiguous? When I read it, I found it to be very straightforward. Would you agree with that?
I think the trust is fairly straightforward, yes. And when we talk about the right of first refusal, we're talking about the right not being expressly prohibited by the trust agreement.
And that leads me to my next question. And I'm looking at respondent's brief on page 7, where he, in the middle of it, of the brief, quotes, in the event purchaser John Cordes should ever sell or intend to sell any of the portion of the property, you know which part I'm talking about in the contract for deed. And
correct.
So my question to you is, where is that language in the trust? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying it wasn't prohibited. It wasn't expressly in the trust, but it wasn't prohibited by the trust. Is that your argument?
Well, that's right, Your Honor. And there's a little bit more to it, if I may. So it is not expressly prohibited by the trust. That provision was suggested in response to a language in John's proposed contract for deed that was directly contrary to the actual language in the trust about the 10-year sale restriction. And the language was suggested by the lawyer, drafted by the lawyer, who had actually drafted the trust agreement. So the trustees were relying on that lawyer for that language. That lawyer doesn't appear to believe that that violated the trust. And part of the reason that we're able to say that is because if you see 0.0 0803R, it says that the terms of the trust are the manifestation of the settler's intent as shown in the trust agreement or by other admissible evidence. So it's sort of the idea that.
So what is the manifestation of intent by the settler of the trust to allow a right of first refusal, either in the language of the document itself or the evidence that was submitted before the district court?
Yes, and that the first part of that, Your Honor, is that all sides agree that the intent of both Avis and Lloyd, who had a similar trust document drafted, was to keep that land in the family. So the right of first refusal follows that interest. It is intended to accomplish that intent. So that's the manifestation. When we say the manifestation of intent, we're talking about the undisputed evidence and testimony from all sides that the intent of Avis was to keep this land in the family. And so what we have is a situation where John made a proposal that seemed to try to defeat that. And so the trustees responded in a way that they thought was consistent with the trust and with the intent of the settler. And that is, well, John, if you're going to sell it, we want to at least have the right of first refusal because we're family. And it's just us, it's nobody else. But if you want to give it to family, the way you got it under the trust or in some other device or other gift, we have no role in that. We don't oppose that. So that was the idea behind it, the driving intent.
John said that he wanted to have his son continue the family farm for a third generation. And the language that Attorney Rockney wrote up says to any third party. It doesn't say to any third party except a family member.
Well, that's true. Although it does say that by gift, devise, or other similar method like that. And what John's testimony actually was, and we didn't know this until after the fact, until after he tells us at the hearing. But what John actually wanted to do was exactly what his parents had done for him in this trust. And so, in fact, that language of the exception within the right of first refusal allows exactly that, doesn't bar that at all. So what the trustees were doing were saying,
understanding is that Avis and Lloyd didn't gift this property to John. I mean, he had to pay some money for it at a reduced rate, but it wasn't a total gift. Which is what he wanted to do with his son, as I understand the record.
But the way they did it was through the trust document. So that's a devise. They devised an option to John, and John can devise an option to one of his children or one of his family members in a similar trust. He wants to do the same thing his parents did, and he can do exactly that. That right of first refusal doesn't give Cynthia or Scott any right to match that because it's a devise. It was done by devise in the trust. So the issue on removal really involves statutory construction because we have 501c.0706 subdivision 1a. You don't get to remove a trustee for breach of trust. You only get to remove a trustee for a serious breach of trust. And then we look at the statutes as to the duties of trustees, 501c.0801, 0802, 0803, and 0804 define the overarching duties of trustees. And under 0801, they have to act in good faith. They have to act consistent with the terms and purpose and interests of the trust and the interests of all the beneficiaries. Under 0802, they have to act with loyalty to all the beneficiaries. Interests above those of the beneficiaries. Under 0.0803, when there's more than one beneficiary, which is true in this case, the trustee has to administer the trust impartially with regard to every beneficiary's interests. And under 0.0804, the trust has to be administered according to its terms and purposes and distribution requirements. So John argues in this case, well,
Mr. Atmore, I realize that I'm speculating perhaps a little, but indulge me. So John did not accept his appointment as trustee. Originally, it looks like it was going to be the surviving spouse, so Lloyd in this case, and then his three kids would take the place of Avis. John didn't accept his trusteeship for whatever reason. I don't know that that's in the record. Your clients did. And as the district court wrote, somewhere, somehow, the relationship among the three siblings went south. And so you can see in finding this right of first refusal written by Attorney Rockney that the district court may have thought there's no way that there can be even an appearance of impartiality or trying to benefit all three beneficiaries, including John. And I'm wondering if that's part of the district court's reasoning for what the court did.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. What I can say is those are not the only three beneficiaries. And that's a key point that I think the district court missed. Lloyd is the current income beneficiary of that trust. He also has the right to distribution of principal in some instances. And I think that totally got ignored by the district court. And that fact has to drive a lot of what the trustees did here, because, and I'm jumping ahead a bit, but John is not doing anything. So he's got this option and he doesn't exercise it. It's just sitting out there. And then the trustees say, John, they send a letter, John, you need to exercise this option if you want it. That's what mom wanted you to have if you needed it, wanted it. Then he exercises the option. But again, he sits, nothing happens. So the trustees again move forward. They try to move it along. Let's have a family meeting. We'll discuss the option. We'll discuss its terms. They have that meeting. Terms are agreed to and discussed. Then he proposes through counsel something entirely different than what the trust allows. He wants to cut off that 10-year sale restriction. And all the while, time is going by. There's no income coming into the trust. John's got the property. He's farming it in 2018. He doesn't pay any rent. No income's coming into the trust. Lloyd is a beneficiary. He gets the income. So the trustees are not just thinking about the three children. And I think it's a mistake to focus, because we're talking, and I know that it happens because we're talking about a right of first refusal and John's option under that trust. But when you're operating as a trustee, you're looking at all the issues. You're looking at everything the trust. You can't just look at that one option or John's sole interest. That's wrong. That would be a breach of trust. So what they're doing is they're trying to push it along. And they know, as the record reflects, that the property was supposed to stay in the family. That's the whole point. And so they get this signal from John with his proposal, well, maybe I don't want to keep it in the family. Maybe I just want to sell it. And so they seek advice from the counsel who drafted the agreement, and they come up with a response that tries to limit what the risk is to the intent of the settlor. And so when you put all that together, and then you see that nothing happens because John won't discuss anything for whatever reason, nothing happens for the balance of 2018 and into 2019. There's no income coming into that trust from this property. It's a major asset. It hasn't been sold under the option. It can't be sold to a third party because John Meanwhile, he's not paying any rent. And so what are they supposed to do at that point? Well, they say, John, to John through council, we need to move this thing along. Don't farm it in 2019. We're in spring of 2019 now, and nothing's come in on this property. Don't farm it. Got to come to some agreement on what you're going to pay for farming that land if you want to farm it. And that's when this petition starts. But if you put it all together and look at it in total, instead of just focusing on this option, you see why I think you have to get to the conclusion that an error was made below. Because their duty is broader than just making sure that John's interests are protected. Now, John says that that's their sole duty. Well, it's not. That's contrary to law. He says they don't. Good faith has nothing to do with it. Well, good faith is the requirement of the statute.
They Council, were at all. Your time has expired. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. And who is appearing on behalf of respondent?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Bill Hart, and I represent the respondent, John Cordes. So the district court ordered Scott and Cynthia removed as trustees based on what it determined to be two serious breaches of trust. First, their failure to follow the terms of the trust. Second, their breach of the duty of loyalty stemming from their creating a self-serving situation through their conduct. And so I'd like to talk about those two things. And we'll start with what counsel spent most of his time on this morning, and that was their failure to administer the trust in accordance with its terms. I thought I heard an agreement that the trust is unambiguous. And yet the trustees gave themselves a perpetual right of first refusal that is inconsistent with the provisions of the trust. The trust has an express provision saying how and for how long the land is to be encumbered, and they changed that provision by adding a new one. Now, the argument I heard today was, well, everyone agrees that it was the intent of the settlor to keep the land in the family, so it's within the power of the trustees to do whatever they want to effectuate that purpose. That is the essence of the argument they're making today. They think that the provision that was in the trust isn't sufficient to effectuate the settlor's intent, and so they decided they were going to put in a new one. And I can't find any law, appellants have not cited any law, allowing a trustee to enforce the intent of the trust by changing the terms of the trust. And there's just simply no law that allows that. And there's no rule also allowing trustees to deviate from the trust just because they find the beneficiary difficult to deal with. I heard the question, what are we supposed to do? They're supposed to go to court with a petition for instruction. That's what they're supposed to do. And instead, what they did was they threatened John that he could never farm the land unless he signed something that was inconsistent with the trust. And then just walked away and did nothing. They're the trustees. It's their obligation to bring the option that John timely exercised to a conclusion. Under Minnesota law, we know that that option created an executory contract for the sale of the land, and they did nothing to bring that to a head. Now they're saying that, well, for what I heard this morning, for whatever reason, nothing happened until April. Well, yeah, the reason was they didn't do anything as trustees to do it. The complaint this morning I heard was, well, Lloyd is a beneficiary. Yeah, Lloyd's the beneficiary, and it was their obligation to timely deliver the proceeds of that option sale to the trust, and they didn't do it. And the judge specifically said in his order that it was their responsibility for the delay, that the delay was their responsibility. So if Lloyd did not receive income via the proceeds from the trust, it was the trustee's obligation to do that. They were supposed to do that. And so if Lloyd has a problem with the trustees, his remedy is with the trustees. But they don't get to go out and threaten the beneficiary and say that we're going to change the terms of this trust to your detriment, and you're either going to sign this or we're not going to move forward as trustees. The intent. Councils focus a lot on the intent. The 10-year consent provision is the expression of the intent. It provided a check on a sale outside the family for 10 years. And it provided a disincentive to sell at all during that time by providing a $1,500 per acre upcharge. And they wanted, they just simply changed that. That was the intent of the settlor. That was the expression of her intent. And the argument today is just, we get to change it because we thought that, you know, John, you know, we thought that John might sell it to someone else. Well, they had 10 years to prevent that. And their response to John's proposal, if it was inconsistent with the trust, which it was to say, no, we will not do that. We will only give you what is provided for in the trust. And so again, their argument today is, nope, he created some uncertainty for us. And so we as trustees are simply going to change the trust completely. And you know, there's just no law out there. In fact, there's probably not a single beneficiary who hasn't, tried to get more from the trustee than the trustee is at liberty to give. That's a common scenario in every trust. But that scenario can't possibly provide a basis for the trustee then to then change the terms of the trust. They just simply say, no, that's what a trustee is supposed to do. And that's especially true when the trustees made the change and took a personal interest in the trust property. It's just flabbergasting to hear the trustees say that they have the right to do that, contrary to the trust, because they think they're better enforcing the intent of the settlor than the settlor did herself. There's nothing to support that. And the fact that they continue to argue that even today is the strongest possible endorsement of the district court's ruling that Scott and Cynthia had demonstrated not just that they didn't follow the terms of the trust, their inability to follow the terms of the trust. They're continuing to argue today that they don't have to. And of course they can't be allowed to continue as trustees when their argument is we don't have to follow the terms of the trust if we think we have a better idea for how to effectuate the intent of the trust of the trust settlor. I heard a question this morning about from the court, Judge Riley, about the sibling enmity, and that's absolutely right. There is considerable enmity between these. The district court made that as a finding of fact, and that permeates the entire course of the trustee's conduct.
I have another question, which is neither here nor there, but I am the granddaughter of farmers. So I saw that originally the Lloyd and John farmed over 300 acres.
Yes.
And this trust concerns 160 acres. What happened to the other acreage?
So I believe, Your Honor, is that half of it was in Avis's trust and half of it was in Lloyd's trust, and Lloyd is still living. So I believe that remains in Lloyd's trust. It certainly didn't come to what happened. Really, truly, what happened was that I believe that when Avis died, the land could go to Lloyd's trust pursuant to the terms of Avis's trust, but he just claimed his interest in it, and that's how it became available to John through the option. But the other half is in Lloyd's trust, and he's still living. And so, you know, ultimately, Your Honor, you know, the suggestion about sibling enmity is, you know, one of the concerns a court has to have in exercising its judgment is, you know, the secret intentions of the trustees and whether they're going to be able to basically hide themselves from judicial review by purporting to exercise the powers of trustee. And the court specifically made reference to that rule of law. He specifically made reference to the sibling enmity. And that alone should be sufficient to uphold the court's order removing them as trustees, because, you know, a trusteeship is the highest, requires the highest possible form of loyalty. And they've shown that they don't have it. And they've shown that the reason they don't have it is that they are angry with their brother. It seems unfathomable to me that there's a contention that the district court did not have any leeway to remove them as trustees based on the facts. I mean, the seriousness of a breach of trust has to be evaluated within the context of the dispute and within the context of the conduct that the trustees displayed. And it essentially reflects the trial court's judgment as to the suitability of the trustees to continue in the role requiring the highest possible duty of loyalty. And just the fact that they're unable to set aside their sibling enmity is enough on its face to require new trustees to be brought in. You don't just get to keep going just because you were originally appointed. I don't know that I have anything else, Your Honor. I guess I do have one more thing I wanted to discuss, and that is two more things, possibly. First of all, you don't get to go to a lawyer and get permission to breach the terms of the trust. That's not a shelter from the failure to follow the terms of the trust. And what lawyer would tell you that you get to add your own terms to the trust? But regardless, that's not an excuse that prevents a judge from exercising his or her discretion to remove a trustee. As to John's behavior, the standard for removal of a trustee asks whether the trustee committed a serious breach of trust, not whether the beneficiary is a difficult person, not whether they hate each other, not whether the beneficiary has provoked them to the point of they're feeling that they need to retaliate. It looks specifically and exclusively at the conduct of the trustee. That's what the test says. As far as the notion of, well, you know, the lawyer told me we could do it and we did this in good faith and we're just trying to keep the land and the family. Good faith is an enumerated duty in the statute. And so, yeah, you have to act in good faith, but that's not a defense. It's required that you act in good faith, but it's not sufficient. Otherwise, the statute would simply have one duty, act in good faith. But it doesn't. It says act in good faith and follow the terms of the trust and act with loyalty toward the beneficiary. And so just you can't hide behind the claim that you were doing it in good faith. That's just the whole point of the judicial concern about hiding behind your title of trustee to execute your secret intentions. just saying that you had good faith does not excuse obvious and blatant breaches of the trust, both in loyalty and in the failure to follow their terms. So ultimately, you know, we're asking obviously for the court to affirm the decision of the district court. The findings of fact are more than well supported in the evidence. They're not clearly erroneous. And the ultimate decision to remove was well within the court's discretion. And so the court should affirm those things. I do have time for questions, of course. There's
any
just
questions?
A little bit of minute left.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Atmore, do you have a rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. So we heard a lot about hostility, and I just want to talk about that for a minute for a couple of reasons. One is, contrary to counsel's argument, in fact, the law says that if a beneficiary creates hostility, the beneficiary can't use that hostility to try to remove trustees. That's the In re Hill Trust case cited in our brief. And you know, in trust and estates matters, it's almost always the case that these are about family. They all involve the family dynamics, and including the underlying and long simmering conflicts and interpersonal relationships and issues that come to the fore when the parent dies and there's an estate involved. And that's especially true, I think, where the trustee is a family member. And I think the law is designed to recognize this. It tries to strike a balance. It says the trustees have to act in good faith. They have to look out for all the beneficiaries, have to follow the intent of the settlor. They can't put themselves above the beneficiaries. But conversely, the law says a beneficiary can't have a trustee removed just because of an alleged breach of trust. It's got to be serious. It's got to be serious or repetitive conduct that clearly is contrary to law in the terms of the trust. And the beneficiary can't create the hostility to get the trustee removed. So I think one of the jobs of a district court in a case like this is to dig deeply into the facts and see what's being urged by one side and whether it's really borne out by the facts. And here it wasn't. The facts do not bear out this hostility that's claimed from the trustees to John. And the reason it doesn't are the things I talked about before. And that is, they are the ones who said, John, are you going to exercise the option? They're the ones who said, John, let's get together and figure out what the terms are going to be. They are the ones who said, let's get this done. Not John. And in fact, this whole trusteeship issue with John, yes, he did not sign a acceptance. That is correct. Was he a trustee or not was it never determined. You know, you can be a trustee if you take control of trust property, which he did. He was farming that land. So part of the issue and part of the hostility he creates is that he really isn't doing anything. He's not acting like a trustee. He maybe wants to keep that behind him so he can make changes to what the trust says, make offers on his contract for deed that are different than the trust. And he wants to just sort of wait and see. And it's free to him. He's not paying rent. He's not paying anything. And you know, one of the things to think about too, I think, is the trustees didn't come down harshly on him. They didn't strictly enforce the 60-day limit and other things in the trust agreement, which they could have done. They wanted to do what was right and follow through on what the trust allowed. And they say, well, what they should have done is gone into court. Well, you know, again, this goes back to the family dynamics. They're not trying to start a fight. They're not, you know, people see these petitions as lawsuits. And Lloyd is still alive. He clearly doesn't want a dispute among his children. He doesn't want to come testify, as the court noted. And So the trustees are trying to do things short of having to create this petition and a lawsuit. And really, if you look at the evidence, what it shows is that John created this hostile dynamic, and then he tried to use it as a sword in his petition. And I don't think the evidence supports that. What the judge said is that, well, the right of first refusal that was proposed, it wasn't enforced. It wasn't forced on anybody. It was proposed. John thinks everyone's negotiating. And then the judge says, well, that was essentially a snowball effect. And everything comes from that. But if you go back to that, when you have the advice of counsel, the counsel that wrote the trust agreement and says, this is the way to craft it that preserves everybody's rights and gives John what he wants, you can't say that's a serious breach of trust or bad faith. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.